Las Vegas and our beautiful campus. It is our pleasure to co-host today the National Clean Energy Summit 2 with Senator Harry Reid and the Center for American Progress Fund. Something really special is happening here at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, and in Las Vegas. Last year, at the first National Clean Energy Summit, President Clinton and Senator Reid challenged us to become the solar capital of the world and to look for new technologies that would create a cleaner future. And I'm glad to tell you that here at UNLV, we've accepted that challenge along with our partners from the Desert Research Institute, from Nevada Energy, and other places. And now we can say that we are moving fast. We've had over $55 million of funding in clean energy, including smart grid technology, photovoltaics, solar catalyzed hydrogen, and a host of other projects that we think will make a difference, change our economy, create jobs, and build a cleaner, more sustainable future for Las Vegas, Nevada, and for our country. We have to, in particular, give Senator Majority Leader Reid congratulations for leading the fight in Washington to push the U.S. and Nevada to the forefront of the clean energy revolution. His efforts are putting us on the map, and we are well positioned to be on the fast track with him. Nevada is going to make the shift to a clean energy economy, and UNLV, through our educational programs and research programs, are there to help train the future leaders and the workforce that our state will need. Our faculty will continue to bring their research forward to create new technologies and new business opportunities. It's an exciting time for all of us, and today you're going to be treated to an incredible conversation about the clean energy future that we all seek, about jobs, fuel innovation, and how to protect our environment. Please join me in welcoming our distinguished roundtable panelists to the stage.
We've finally gotten our seats. Good morning, everyone. I'm John Podesta. I'm the president of the Center for American Progress Action Fund. And before I get started, I'd like to thank Senator Harry Reid, who is not only the majority leader in the United States Senate and the leader of the Senate, but a leader on these clean energy issues. And I want to thank our host, the University of Nevada at Las Vegas, and all the people who have helped put this on and have co-sponsored this event with us. I appreciate their leadership on this issue, the work they've put into this event to ensure its success. We organized this summit to discuss policy ideas to speed and ease the transition to a clean energy economy, and how in doing so we can spur private investment, save consumers money, and put Americans back to work in steady jobs that pay a living wage, provide good benefits, and can't be shipped overseas. This event occurs, I think, at a great time because this fall the United States Senate plans to begin debate and consideration of clean energy and global warming pollution reduction policies. The ideas we generate here can inform and enhance this debate, and we're pleased to welcome Senator Maria Cantwell from Washington, who is a leader in this fight in the United States Senate, along with Senator Reid. As the President noted, we've held one meeting here a year ago, and we held a meeting in in Washington in February, and I think one of the things we've learned in our past meetings is that clean energy infrastructure works best when it works together. Electric cars can use electricity created by wind turbines and solar power. A smart grid can efficiently bring renewable electricity from points of generation in deserts and plains to points of consumption in cities and towns. Efficiency and renewable electricity standards and an effective price on carbon pollution can create the incentives for sustained private investment that can jumpstart American production of the clean energy technology and the clean energy technology industries of the futures. With supportive federal policies, huge shale gas that are newly available because of American know-how and technology can replace old, dirty coal power plants, dramatically reducing global warming pollution. And natural gas can supplement wind and solar energy to solve the intermittency problem that comes with renewable energy. Finally, a green bank can provide secure, affordable financing to get new technologies off the ground and into the marketplace. President Obama, I believe, understands this fundamental point. All the elements of a clean energy economy rely on one another. That's why he's made transforming our economy to a clean energy base so central to economic recovery, and we're so glad to have so many distinguished members of his administration here with us this morning. Progressive leaders in Congress have also shown they believe in the centrality of clean energy to the future of the country and are committed to realizing its potential. The House recently passed legislation that was the first time that comprehensive clean energy legislation would create a market for renewable energy, expand clean energy manufacturing, improve efficiency to save consumers money, reduce oil use, and create jobs for American workers. In the Senate, Majority Leader Reid is leading the way and helping craft a smart, practical bill that prioritizes a coherent strategy and lays the groundwork for this transformation. Last year's summit, we focused on how we got renewables to market and how we built a smart grid that improved the efficiency, security, and the reliability that opened up the potential for the vast amount of renewables that we have available in this country. Today, we're going to focus on two additional areas. Today, TAP and the Energy Future Coalition are releasing a report called Rebuilding America. The report shows that retrofitting 50 million homes and small commercial buildings could create 625,000 sustained jobs in construction and manufacturing and save consumers up to $64 billion in their energy bills. To reap these rewards, we need new policies to help the market work and capture the benefit in jobs, investment, and consumer savings. We're also going to propose today policies that would take advantage of the recent capacity to tap our enormous shale gas reserves. This resource could be a global warming game changer because gas could provide relatively cheap domestic low-carbon energy to provide electricity and power heavy-duty trucks, buses, and other fleet vehicles. This and many other ideas from this gathering have become the previous gatherings have become law already. We expect the discussion today to be hope form and inform the upcoming Senate debate. And I'm confident that this year's summit will reach Washington's leaders and achieve measurable impact. In closing, let me say that that I want to just talk for a minute about how the day will flow for all the people in the audience. After this panel, we're going to take a lunch break. After lunch, we'll hear from my good friend President Bill Clinton. After President Clinton's speech, we're going to conduct a town hall forum featuring Vice President Gore, Majority Leader Reid, T. Boone Pickens, and Assistant Secretary of Energy Kathy Zoi. That's a chance for everybody to participate by asking questions. Beginning now and continuing throughout the day, you can send us a question or comment through a text message, email, or writing on the card included in your registration packet. To send us a text message in the two box on your phone, enter 99503. And then the very first words in the body of the test should be ask NCEP, no spaces, ASKNCEP. To enter a question on the web, send an email to questions@cleanenergysummit.org. And don't forget to include your name and hometown in the body of your email and text message. With that, let me now turn it over to my good friend and a great leader, Harry Reid.
I first want to acknowledge and thank the University of Nevada at Las Vegas and our new president. We are known for producing great athletes, but we're now going to be known for producing great scientists. That's so important, and this university is moving into a new sphere in the academic world, and we'll hear more from the president about this at a later time. A year or so ago, I started taking missionary lessons from a group supporting T. Boone Pickens. I've taken the missionary lessons, I've met with him, and I've been converted. I now belong to the Pickens Church, okay? We're very thankful to have him here. He's been a good friend and a real visionary. We look forward to hearing from President Clinton this afternoon. Secretary Chu, it was just a year ago that you and I at the same facility, at this first summit, first met. We had a number of very nice visits during the day that we spent together, neither of us knowing the great change that would take place in this country with the election, and certainly neither you or I expecting that you would be part of this cabinet of President Obama. You've done a great job. You're recognized not only in our country but around the world, one of America's great scientists, one of the world's great scientists. We're so happy that you're here today. Labor Secretary Solis, we're so happy that you're here. The great California delegation produced one of its best in making you part of President Obama's cabinet. We appreciate your being here. We, until a couple of hours ago, were expecting Governor Schwarzenegger. I think, as some of you know, the state of California, it seems like on a daily basis, has a perfect storm. Prison riots yesterday. And then, of course, we all recognize Eunice Kennedy Shriver, his mother-in-law, is extremely ill. And he said he felt it would be inappropriate for him to be here today. I have enjoyed working with him on high-speed rail. California and Nevada have signed a partnership working to bring high-speed rail to this part of the country. It's necessary for the environment and the economy. And finally, the mayor of Los Angeles. That city is bigger than more than 40 states in population. We're happy to have him here. I so appreciate the friendship we've developed over the years. During my difficult times, I've received phone calls from him, and during good times, I received phone calls from him. That's a true sign of friendship. It was on August 10th, 1776, that word reached London that the Americans had drafted the Declaration of Independence. The revolution that followed set our nation and the world, but especially our nation, on a long journey toward prosperity and global leadership. Today, August 10th, here in Las Vegas, we're firing the first shots of a new revolution to regain that prosperity and restore that leadership. A clean energy revolution that will create millions of jobs across America and thousands of jobs right here in Nevada. We dedicate this year's summit to creating new, good jobs, good paying jobs that can never be outsourced. I can see new jobs in construction, manufacturing, and engineering, new opportunities that will reverberate to countless other industries in our country. And we'll lower every American's energy bill. We're at it by promoting rapid investment in energy-efficient buildings and technology. When we harness the power of the sun, wind, and water all around us, we'll not only strengthen our environment and strengthen our national security, we'll turn around our economy so it can recover and flourish once again. But just as this crisis was not created in a day, recovery will not happen overnight. So we must begin. If we do not start today to create the jobs of tomorrow, those jobs will surface on other shores. Though we innovate, invest, and invent, we already trail competing countries in the global economy, places that we should be leading. The year was 1982. The new Congress was organizing, and a frightened young, newly elected congressman from Nevada had been assigned to the Energy and Technology Committee. And we went there for organizational activities of that committee. And a young man came to me and said, I'm Al Gore from Tennessee. And I have gotten permission from the chairman of the committee, Don Fuqua of Florida, to form a new subcommittee. He said, all the other people are being running to those established subcommittees. You get on mine, and we'll have a good time. And I followed the suggestion, and we had a good time. We looked at stuff that no one had looked at before. We looked at FEMA. We looked at the future of jobs in America. We looked at transplants, which were just beginning. A little girl by the name of Jamie Fisk was brought in, whose liver had failed her. And it was the beginning of a revolution in transplantation of organs to survive, to allow people like little Jamie Fisk to survive. That was the beginning of a journey through these many years of developing one of the most wonderful friendships that could exist on this earth. I have so much respect for Vice President Gore, and that it's hard to convey this to the people here. But I will say, as I said at an earlier time today, how fortunate we are to have a man that has won a Nobel Peace Prize, an Emmy, and an Oscar, my friend Al Gore.
Thank you very much, Senator Reid. Ladies and gentlemen, it's great to be back in Nevada. Great to be back in Las Vegas. Senator Reid is leading the United States Senate and the legislative branch of our government and our country toward repowering America. And indeed, everything he said about our close and deep friendship for many years is something that I would second over and over again. I'm reminded of a story looking at all the jobs that are already beginning to be planned out and created here in Nevada. A story from Tennessee when, over 60 years ago, Albert Einstein and one of his colleagues wrote him a letter saying that it was possible to create an atomic bomb, and the Germans, the German Reich was close to it, they feared, and we needed to really get busy and save ourselves. And so President Roosevelt invited in the majority leader and the speaker and the two chairmen of the appropriations committees, House and Senate, and laid out these facts, told them how urgent it was, how important it was to keep it completely secret. It's going to take a lot of money, but the nation's survival could well be at stake. And he went to the majority leader, and majority leader at that time said, Mr. President, our country is at stake, of course. We'll put it in there, and we'll hide it, and we'll do this. The speaker gave the same response. Chairman of the House Appropriations Committee gave basically the same response. And then it came to the chairman of the Senate Appropriations Committee, a man named Senator Kenneth D. McKellar, and he said, Mr. President, the future of all civilization may well ride on this decision. Where in Tennessee are we going to build it? And a little place called Black Oak Ridge became Oak Ridge, Tennessee, Oak Ridge National Laboratory. And when the scientists informed the leaders of our country that we need a renewable energy revolution to save our climate and a national smart grid and efficiency and all the measures that we're talking about here, he didn't say the exact words, but I could see him thinking it. Where in Nevada are we going to build it? Now I know the answer, at the University of Las Vegas, right, and other places in Nevada. And indeed, there are lots and lots of good jobs in this effort to repower America. I have spent the last 2 years conducting now 32 so-called solution summits, delving very deeply into every aspect of this, and I am more convinced than ever that we have all the tools that we need to solve three or four climate crises. We've only got to solve one. But we can do it, and of course, we must do it. And President Obama made a down payment on his promise to do just that in the Recovery Act back in February with historic national investments in energy efficiency, alternative energy, a new advanced smart grid, public transportation, high-speed rails, and all of the rest. So we are on the move. The House of Representatives took another historic step with passage of the legislation, which not only puts a cap on the pollution that causes global warming, but puts in place real incentives for energy efficiency and the development of alternative, no-carbon and low-carbon energy sources across our economy to create jobs and improve our national security. And now the Senate is prepared to take up climate and energy legislation this fall in advance of the global treaty talks in Copenhagen in the first 12 days of December. States like Nevada, my home state of Tennessee, and every state, Senator Cantwell's home state, Mayor Villaraigosa's home city, he's already doing a great deal. Senator Cantwell's been a great leader on this. And we are so fortunate to have Secretary Chu, Secretary Solis, as a part of this historic effort, two great leaders. Business leaders like my friend Boone Pickens and many others gathered around this table have been very vocal and energetic in moving what is an agenda in the interests of all Americans. John Podesta and his Center for American Progress have played an invaluable role. Tim Wirth, my colleague and partner for 33 years now, first in the House, then in the Senate. We were on the same committee way back when, and he has remained a tremendous leader in all of this. We have three crises, of course. Our national security is threatened by our continuing dangerous vulnerability to the oil reserves that are really centered in the Persian Gulf. The International Energy Agency just put out its first ever state of the world oil supply just last week and found that the decline in the pumping rate from the 800 largest fields has been going down much more rapidly than had been predicted only a few years ago. We've heard from people who know about these things for several years that there was no transparency and not full candor in exactly what the status of these oil reserves was, and now we're piercing that veil by looking at exactly what's produced under what economic circumstances, and you put that together with the data that is available, and it's very clear that this roller coaster of oil prices going up and down, when they go way up, we get energized and say, oh, we're going to take control of our own destiny and we're not going to let them do it to us anymore. And then they come back down again and we just relax again. President Obama referred to that pattern as going from shock, from shock to trance. We get a moment of alert of alarm and urgency, and then the prices go back down and we just relax again. Well, I don't think we're going to follow that same pattern or make that same mistake this time around. So in addition to our national security crisis, we also have an ongoing economic crisis. We all applaud the faint signs that the recession may be over, but we know that while the credit crisis is easing, the global recession is still rumbling along and unemployment is still at unacceptable levels, and this recent good news on unemployment may be temporary indeed. So what we need is a national effort to prime the pump and get our economy going. And just what the doctor ordered is a national program to repower America and make our buildings more efficient and build a unified national smart grid and catch up with the 21st century and use renewable sources and smart meters and all of the other new resources that are now available to us. And of course, we face a climate crisis. The fashion has become to call it something else, call it energy, call it whatever, but sooner or later we're going to have to come to grips with the fact that the climate crisis is threatening the future of our civilization. And just because those words sound shrill is no excuse for not saying them. We have to face up to this. We're putting another 70 million tons of global warming pollution into the thin shell of atmosphere surrounding our planet every 24 hours. This is madness. We owe it to ourselves and especially to our children and grandchildren and future generations. Who are we to make a decision to just keep on being so wasteful and destructive in the teeth of the warnings from every single prestigious scientific organization on this planet? Every single National Academy of Sciences in the world has endorsed the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report, saying we have got to act on this. And if our kids years from now say, didn't you notice that the entire North Polar ice cap was melting in the summer of 2009 in just a few years' time? Didn't you care about that? Didn't you notice these storms? Didn't you notice the 1,000-year droughts, the 500-year floods, all of the rising sea levels, the trees dying all across the American West? What were y'all doing? Watching American Idol? Or what? Sooner or later, we're going to have to wake up and really take this on for what it is. This is our generation's mandate, mission, and responsibility. And thank goodness that Harry Reid is where he is and that he's brought us all here together to make some more steps in the right direction. And thank goodness that so many business leaders are now getting so deeply involved in this. I look forward to today's sessions. I know that I've got to confine my remarks to 5 minutes, but you can tell I feel pretty strongly about this. I think that we have got to solve this, and we've got to get moving. So, Senator Reid, thank you so much for bringing us here. There's hardly anything I wouldn't do for Harry Reid, and I bet you the vast majority of people in this gathering feel exactly the same way. So thank you very much, Harry.
Governor Schwarzenegger was to introduce Tim Worth, but it's a pleasure for me to introduce Tim. Tim and I served in the House together. We came to the Senate together. Tim, when he came to the Senate, was one of those only a handful of senators who recognized the importance of talking about global warming. It was not done very often. Two of the senators doing it at the time were both in this room, Worth and Gore. Since then, Tim Worth has always been one of the strongest supporters of a cleaner America and a cleaner planet. He's done a lot since leaving the Senate, more than most former senators, for sure. He has never lost his zeal for recognizing the need to change public policy. Tim helped elect Bill Clinton and Al Gore. He served in the State Department as its first Undersecretary of Global Affairs. He was a country's lead negotiator at the Kyoto Climate Conference. He's done many great things, one of which is to help bring baseball to Denver. Tim serves now as President of the United Nations Foundation. I'm so appreciative that he's going to be our moderator here today. And Tim, thank you very, very much for being here and being the person you are.
Great, Harry. Thank you very much. And I'm delighted to be here, as all the panelists are. And as before, we thank you, Harry, for bringing us all together and the University of Nevada and Las Vegas. Well, we have two but seemingly separate themes today. One is energy efficiency, the other is renewables, both the most immediate and fastest routes to the new clean energy economy. These are two issues that can be discussed together, can be done separately, can be made enormously complicated or can be simplified to the point where they really give us each a roadmap. And we're going to try to do the latter this morning. We're going to try to break these down in such a way that we hope all of you will walk away with a better sense for not only what you can do, what can be done here in Nevada, but also can create a base for the very, very significant task that Senator Reid has in trying to garner the support in the United States Senate for the kind of diverse and very important urgent legislation on energy jobs, energy security, and climate change, the urgent legislation the country needs. We're going to start today focusing on the renewable side, and I'm going to ask Secretary Chu to kick us off. I just wanted to warn him that he's going to be first up in the blocks here. These people do not know the order yet, but we are going to split, sort of do the first 45 minutes on renewables and technology, the second 45 minutes on efficiency and the barriers to efficiency and what can be done. So, Steve, you're going to be first up, but before getting to you, I'm going to ask Dr. Keith Schwer, the director of the Center for Business and Economic Research and a member of the UNLV Economics Department, to give us an opening statement. Keith Schwer specializes, and all of you from Nevada would be particularly interested in this. He focuses in particular on the business and economic environment of Las Vegas and Nevada and on the whole region. So what he's going to do is to take a few minutes to describe the economic development and job creation potential of clean energy here in Nevada. Then I'm going to move to Steve Chu and then go to Mark Porat and give you all, I'll give you each a sort of a two-person ahead warning as to when you're on so you can fit this into the overall narrative. But Steve Schwer, Steve.
Thank you. As a faculty member, I wish to welcome you to UNLV. First, I'd like to begin by noting that the current unemployment rate in Clark County, is a population of 2 million people, Las Vegas is its major city, is 12.3%. The national number is 9.4%. That is a significant rise for us, a complete change in the economic prosperity and the economic dimension of our community. And it's very appropriate at this time that we should step back and think about where it is we're going and what the future should be for our children and grandchildren. I want to make three points. Point is to look at a bit the history of Nevada. I think it's informative. Secondly, I'd like to talk about the basic fundamentals of regional economic growth, and then make a few comments about some of the challenges that we face as we look at the energy situation. First, if you look at the growth of Las Vegas, 1900, there were 17 people in Las Vegas. 2000, roughly 2 million. I've done the numbers. By far, we're the fastest growing region in the United States through that century. Why is that? Well, it occurred because of an entrepreneurial spirit and some special things happening in sequence in relatively rapid order. First, of course, was the coming of the railroad, and that brought people here. We came to the railroad came because of comparative advantage of the availability of water in the desert west and the importance of a railroad line from Salt Lake to LA. That was followed, of course, by the Great Boulder Dam, the last, as many have said, the last great government project that came in ahead of schedule and under budget. That opened up many opportunities, water and electricity, that was very important in World War II in providing material that brought, again, government development, the air base, other activities. The third stage was, of course, the development of the Las Vegas Strip. There really were no comparative advantages here. You know, in Kansas, they have a comparative advantage of wonderful land and temperature to grow wheat. We grow orange juice in Florida. We didn't have any comparative advantages, but we found them. And it was the entrepreneurial spirit that resulted in this phenomenal growth to 2 million people here. We'll tell you the last 25 years have been one of great prosperity. The last 2 years, we're seeing that things are changing. I want to come to my second point. With all of this change, how do we look at the future? How do we look at how regions grow? There are two factors. One, now I'll use some fancy economics terms here, but they're pretty simple. The growing of the export base, the second is import substitution. Regional economies are driven by what they sell. Again, Kansas, they produce wheat, they sell wheat. Florida sells orange juice. Texas, Oklahoma, my home state, oil, right? Nevada, we have been selling recreational services. We have a very limited economic base in the state of Nevada, tourism services and mining. We're looking for further development to iron out what will surely be increased cyclicality going forward in time based upon our economy structure. So let's look at what energy addresses in terms of the export base and import substitution. What we know is that Nevada is blessed with renewable energy. What is going to be happening over time is this is going to become our export base. We're going to look like Texas and Oklahoma. We're going to be exporting energy because we can produce it. Now, associated with that, there's some issues of storage and distribution. We're going to be doing things differently. But let me suggest to you those are just roadblocks along the way. And if you look at history, particularly the coming of the railroad, the automobile, electrification, there were always issues that had to be dealt with. Let me turn to the other side, and that's the import substitution issue. And that is, as we grow energy, we're no longer going to be dependent upon energy production in the dangerous part of the world. We're going to be in control of our own destiny. But of course, that's going to create problems for us here, because we're going to have to be able to move from one industry structure to another. The simple example was that jobs were destroyed. You know, if you were in the buggy whip production and with the coming of the automobile, you lost a job. But there were a lot of jobs created by Henry Ford and others with the development of the automobile. The suggestion here is as follows. We shouldn't be afraid of that. Indeed, we should continue to work to make those transformations, to drive our economy, and to ensure the economic prosperity for our grandchildren. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, and that immediately reminds us of the imperative of technology and that we figure out not only how to invent that technology, but how do we get that technology to scale. And what I'd like to do is to start with Steve Chu and go through a discussion of this issue, the development of technology, how do we get it to scale. We'll go have five or six commenters on that, and I will then ask Maria Cantwell to give us a summary of all of that, if I can, Maria, of that first section of 45 minutes. Then I'd like to go back to Vice President Gore and ask him to be kind of the lever point between the two, comment on what he's heard in the first part, and then introduce us to the public policy issues of the second part. How do we deal with energy efficiency, and how do we deal with the institutions of our utilities and so on? If that's all right, Mr. Vice President, that would be a good transition. So I'm going to start with Steve Chu and then go to Mark Porritt and follow him with Steve Rohl. Steve.
Well, thank you, Senator Worth. The United States has an incredible opportunity. We have to have a second industrial revolution. The first industrial revolution gave us power that could relieve us of human labor and animal labor. But it came with a cost, and we only realized in the last couple of decades what that cost was. Well, there are many costs, but certainly the carbon dioxide cost. So in the next industrial revolution, we're going to have to develop technologies that will enable us to get the energy we need to grow and prosper, for the entire developing world to grow and prosper, but with greatly reduced, essentially reducing and eliminating the carbon dioxide. If you look at what the United States has, it has unarguably the greatest research and development centers in the world in our universities, our national labs, and in the private sector. And so once we get this great innovation machine geared and going, we would be invincible. But the only trouble is, let's get it going. So in that respect, I just came back from China 3 weeks ago, and China has realized, number one, the price of oil a couple decades from today will be considerably higher. Number two, and they're now importing 60% of their oil. Number two, we will be living in a carbon-constrained world. From the premier of China on down, they said, this climate change is very, very serious. If we do business as usual, the effects would be devastating to China, devastating to the world. Therefore, we have an opportunity to lead in the Industrial Revolution. And they are gearing up. These are becoming almost protected industries. They are trying to catch up with Vestas and GE and wind turbines. They are going heavily into solar. They are leading the world now in the highest voltage transmission, both AC and DC. And you might be suspicious and say, oh, this is for export. It's business as usual. No. Actually, much of this is for internal consumption. And they have decided that we have to go there, but why not be the leader? Now, quite frankly, the United States is still ahead of China. And why don't we be the leader? So if we move in this direction, we can be the leader and seize the opportunity. If we don't, and just try to say, no, we're not really sure this is all happening, maybe the price of oil will go back to $30 a barrel. Maybe the climate isn't really changing. This is just wishful thinking, and it's just throwing away this great opportunity. So, in terms of renewables, whether it be wind, solar, geothermal, enhanced geothermal, many, many opportunities. We can really take the leadership role in this. It's a remarkable thing, but you have to send first a long-term signal to the people in the United States, to industry, that says, yes, we're going to have a cap on our carbon, and we're going to ratchet it down. Yes, we're going to promote all of those, if you don't mind my venturing a little bit into efficiency, because that is going to be the lowest hanging fruit for the next couple of decades. As we build up the renewables, as we have to build up a modern transmission distribution system, the United States has incredible resources in wind, solar, and agricultural resources. The agricultural resources, that plus the electrification of a personal vehicle fleet, I think has incredible promise to just offload our total dependence on importing oil. The opportunity is enormous. In Department of Energy laboratories, in the first 6 months of the establishment of these laboratories, they've taught and reprogrammed yeast and bacteria, if you feed them simple sugar, to turn those sugars not into alcohol, which I personally prefer to drink, but into gasoline and diesel-like fuel. The yields are low, but hopefully in the next 5 years, they can up the yield so it will be comparable to yeast turning to ethanol. Okay? I would be personally very disappointed if 10 years from now, this hasn't approached real scale. It'll take 5 years to get it going, pilot it, see if it works, and maybe T. Boone Pickens' gas will make the transition. But I think using agricultural waste and crops grown specifically for energy, there will be no competition between food and fuel. The United States, since 1982, we put 75 million acres out of production. 36 million acres went into a conservation preserve, but the rest were essentially paying farmers, look, we're producing too much. That's a lot of acreage. And so if we can grow grasses and very rapidly growing trees that have far less energy inputs, there is an incredible opportunity here. That's something the United States is blessed with so much, and we still have the land, we still have the sun, the water. With climate change, as business as usual, much of our agricultural machinery is at risk. So here's a golden opportunity. The cost of inaction is horrendous, both for our economic prosperity and what climate change can do. But so there are two choices. know, we grow prosperous, we do the right thing, our children and grandchildren will like us, or we can pretend things aren't happening and wish that we were back in 1950. So it's an incredible opportunity. Thank you, Senator.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Secretary. I'm going to, with that as an overview, I'm going to move to two entrepreneurs who've been working in the energy efficiency area, but have been doing so with the development of some brand new and some continuing technologies, and ask the two of them to focus on the issue of, we may have these technologies, they're out there, how do we get them to scale? It's a good idea to have a lot of good ideas, that's just fine. We have an enormous country and an enormous set of problems. Scale, scale, scale. Mark Porat's the first, and Steve Roll is the second from Johnson Controls. But both of you, Mark is a remarkable entrepreneur from Silicon Valley who has chaired and begun all kinds of new ventures thinking about issues of energy. Mark, if you could get us going. And then Steve is the head of Johnson Controls, one of the most, an oldest and most established, most respected companies in this whole space. So if the two of you could help us to think about how do we take the new technologies that will be developed at UNLV and elsewhere and get them into the marketplace and to scale.
Senator Ward, thank you very much. It's an honor to be here in the presence of, you know, really personal heroes of mine, Vice President Gore, personal hero, inspiration, everything I've been doing for 7 years and, you know, intensely. And Secretary Chu, I think you've got the best job on the planet, probably the hardest one. And if you do it right, we're in good shape, and if you don't, we're not. And of course, Senator Reid, it's you know, your courage and steadfastness in the face of this onslaught that's coming in from the radio world and the other world is just unbelievable. And good luck in the fall. We're rooting for you. Silicon Valley, that's where I actually do hail from, although I spend a lot of time now in Washington, D.C. Silicon Valley is a culture that is kind of too naive to not know what we can't do. And 7 years ago, I decided to start a company that's now Sirius Materials, and it was just honored by, you know, in the White House. Well, why? How come? Little tiny company. To set the stage, as you like to do, I think we all know that about 39% of all the energy of America is consumed in operating buildings, just like this. Well-known number. Heating, cooling, lighting, appliances, things of that sort. And on top of that, an additional 12% of total U.S. energy is energy embodied in materials that go into buildings. So half the pie, half of this thing is a big elephant called the built environment, buildings. And it's almost no matter what we do on the supply side, whether it's fossil fuels or nuclear or renewables, all of which should be looked at, and we have to deal with the built environment, almost no matter what we do on the demand side, the efficiency side. We have to look at the built environment because that's half the equation. In your state, Tim, Colorado, we have a national treasure in Amory Lovins, who's been telling us for 30 years that a watt saved is just as good as a watt produced. And now we have reports from McKinsey, which everyone here ought to read. If you haven't picked it up, you should. And another one from CAP, John Podesta's organization, a report written by Bracken Hendricks, that basically says this is the low-hanging fruit. Secretary Chu, I think, calls it fruit that's actually on the ground. It's so low-hanging. You've known this for years because when you were director of Lawrence Berkeley, that was the theme. Great building science department. And incidentally, for those of you in the audience thinking about what you're doing academically, building science is the core of what we need to do to learn to attack the built environment. So let me go back into the built environment again in Sirius Materials. Why did we go to the White House? Why did President Obama invite us? Half of that 39% of U.S. energy that is used to power buildings, if you will, to operate buildings, flies out the window. It's heating and cooling. It's either coming in on a hot day like today, or it's escaping out on a cold day like you know, later on in the winter. And those windows haven't changed in a long time. The interesting thing to a Silicon Valley creature like myself is the built environment has had very little innovation. Everything else that we see is fierce. The computer industry, telecommunications industry, the things in your pockets and the things you drive have evolved. Maybe not the things you drive, but certainly the telecommunications and the computers, the built environment has stayed quite static. So we attacked it with brand new windows that are now operating at 5 times more efficiency than any other window in the world. We've got in the lab windows that are almost the same as basically an insulated exterior wall, 10 times more efficient. And if everything was that class of window, not necessarily for my company, then the United States energy bill would go down by about 10%. That's about as much as all the renewables put together. That's an enormous amount of investment that we wouldn't have to do on the renewable side or on the fossil side or on the nuclear side. We just save it. Makes a lot of sense. Americans love to save. A couple more companies I created, another couple of stories, very quick. CalSTAR. Notice that cement emits as much CO2 and uses an enormous amount of energy, but emits as much CO2 as all the passenger automobiles in this world, on the planet. There's 700 million passenger automobiles. They emit about 4 tons each. That's 2.8 billion tons. Cement, 2.8 billion tons. So we're busy inventing a cement, bricks, blocks, things like that, that don't emit any CO2, or at least 85% less. And we're opening a factory. Zeta, a housing company that basically is making houses in a factory at net zero energy. These things can all be done, and they can all be done beautifully. And so why the White House? Because we took over a factory in Chicago, Sirius Materials did, that collapsed last Christmas. And you should have seen the faces of the people on television who lost their jobs, who were scared, who were angry, and the president said, you have every right to be angry. This is terrible. They didn't get any pay, any severance, no health benefits, nothing. We said, you know what, we're going to buy that thing, take it out of bankruptcy, retool it, bring in Sirius Windows, make windows that are 5 times more efficient, bringing them into the weatherization assistance program in Department of Energy, and it's a 4-for-1 win. Everybody wins, and we did just that, and we happened to do it the day after the stimulus bill was passed, and the day after that we got a call from the White House. This administration understands the connection between jobs, energy, and climate change, and boy, we are so blessed to have this administration at the helm at this time. I'd like to leave you with what I've sort of learned in the last 7 years and manifested in the form of a vision, a mission, a set of entrepreneurial opportunities, and a set of policy requirements. And it all gets wrapped up in something quite simple. Going forward, I would submit, I appeal to you, going forward, all buildings that are built in the future can and should be built to operate at near net zero energy, if not net zero altogether. That's number one. That statement would not have been possible 3 years ago, 5 years ago, so we didn't have the building science, we didn't have the materials, we didn't have design examples you're about to hear from my colleague to my left. We didn't have a lot of stuff, now we do. Build them at net zero. Going back in time, into the existing built environment, that thing that's consuming 39% of all US energy, transform that thing, just like it says in this report, Mr. Podesta's report, transform it as rapidly as possible, take the energy out of it, take half the energy out. 20% is too easy, 30% is doable, take half the energy out. 19% of US energy is sitting in buildings that we don't need. Now, current course and speed, we are doing deep energy retrofits in America. We did 10,000 last year. That's pretty good. One of them was my house, by the way. That's pretty good. That means we're on a 10,000-year trajectory to transform the 120 million buildings of this country. And Senator Reid, is that outside your election cycle? So now, the Obama administration said 1 million. And we're having trouble funding
not
the 1
Senator,
million.
Not Senator Byrd's, though.
Oh, I see. That seems to be the case. So the Obama administration is looking at 1 million, which is very hard to finance and fund. We don't actually have the money for 1 million. But let's say it's 1 million. That's a 110-year cycle. This report, other reports, we are appealing to make that be a 20-year transformation. That's 6 million buildings a year. Almost completely jives in with the numbers that John Podesta highlighted in the beginning. It's doable. It's doable because it's doable. We've got the people. We've got the Secretary of Labor here who's going to stand behind us in training. We've got the building science. We've got the materials, we've got the design examples, we've got the economics. All it takes is, yes, we can. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mark. Let me just set a couple of rules here. We're all going to be here until the last house gets redone if we don't collapse this down and each take, sort of think about the 3 to 5 minute scale, if you would. Steve, you're up next from Johnson Controls, and then I'm going to move to Rose McKinney-James on some of the policy issues that you all have raised.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here today. My lens into this topic really comes from the commercial building market, and specifically, primarily through energy efficiency. But let me try to translate that to the question you raised about technology and renewables. You know, when we talk to our customers, their primary focus isn't around technology as much as it is about solutions. And whether how we bundle technology, what kind of economic value we bring to those customers is really what they're looking for. So our discussions are very much an economic discussion. For example, when we're talking to a school board, the school board wants to understand the payback and the math and how it impacts their budget. They have less interest in terms of what kind of technology we bring. Now, having said that, it's important for us to recognize that technology is moving so quickly that it presents tremendous opportunities for us in the context of what it can do for buildings. You know, we just completed a construction of a facility, and I'm told that within 7 to 10 years, 80% of the 70 renewable projects or new technologies we introduced will be obsoleted by new technology. It's moving that quickly. But if I look at it from the standpoint of barriers and what's going to take place to make this scalable, clearly our ability to find ways to appeal to the financial net present value, the return characteristics that our customers are looking for, that's what we're going to have to meet, whether that's a campus, college campus, whether that's a school district, whether that's a municipality. And one of the ways we can do that is to marry energy efficiency and renewables together. Today, we probably quote 25 to 30% of our work with the renewable content. And the reason we do that is when you marry the two together, you suddenly have an economic package which has a reasonable payback, is attractive to those investors. The scalable issue is something that we can talk about in many ways, but clearly the things we're going to have to talk about deal with everything from the workforce and the technical resources that are required to engineer these projects and bring them to the customers, the financing that's going to be available and how it will spur investment and attract private and public monies. And then finally is just the information we're going to have to go through. We have a lot of education to do with consumers, be it commercial, industrial, or residential, to help them understand exactly what the opportunity might be. Baseline information on existing buildings, there's a tremendous effort that's going to be required up front to help us scale, and that's going to be the challenge for us. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Steve. I'd like to now move to Rose McKinney-James, who's been involved in the policy world related to this for some time, and then go to John Woodard for Bright Science. Rose.
Thank you very much, Senator. I think that throughout this discussion, we've been focused on an important component, which is the policy side of the equation. I'm a former utility regulator at the state level. I know that we are familiar with some of the activities that have been undertaken at the federal level from a regulatory standpoint, but I think there's an urgency around the need to rethink how we communicate with our policymakers at the state and local level to try to create a framework that will advance the discussions that we're undertaking. I mean, we have to start at the ground level. I'm here today representing the Energy Foundation. Many of you are familiar with the work that the foundation has undertaken over the last decade and a half by identifying and funding advocacy organizations around the country to be active in discussions within the bounds of public utility commissions and state legislatures so that we have a policy framework that makes sense. It begins with information and proper communication and leadership. And I think we have identified a range of opportunities in the United States, in a variety of states. Right here in my own state of Nevada, I think we have been very energetic and very aggressive in influencing fairly innovative policy. But I think there is an urgency around connecting what we see at the federal level, Senator Reed's federal energy policy, and ensuring that what we have seen at the state level is just the opportunity to provide a ceiling and not the floor for ensuring that we have the right regulatory framework. I think, Vice President Gore, this morning you said we need to look at a flip. I'm looking forward to that flip because the traditional approach is no longer sufficient to get us where we need to go.
Great.